From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Before the days of the singer-songwriter, before the days when most rock groups wrote their own songs, rock and roll singers relied on songwriters to provide them with good material. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from some of the best of the early rock and roll songwriters. Ellie Greenwich co-wrote Be My Baby, Chapel of Love, and Leader of the Pack. Lieber and Stoller wrote for Elvis, The Drifters, and The Coasters. And Carole King wrote One Fine Day, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, and Up on the Roof. The songwriters of early rock and roll, coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. The snow, sleet, and freezing rain that has hit the Northeast has disrupted electrical service for hundreds of thousands of customers from Texas to Maryland. Mississippi's Public Service Commissioner says they're not talking about hours to restore power. They're talking about days. The week's total of weather-related deaths has reached at least 26. The bad weather in the Northeast has stranded thousands of airline passengers across the country. Tony Molinaro, a spokesman for United Airlines, says the bad weather in the East is affecting operations in the West and Midwest.
We have been canceling many of our inbound flights into the New York area. We're still having problems in Boston and Philadelphia area. Washington this morning, we also were canceling many of our inbound flights, but that is coming back up again sooner than expected.
At LaGuardia Airport in New York, a jetliner is stuck at the end of the runway. A spokesman for the airport says they're going to have to pull it back with a tug and tow it to the gate. He says other planes are being kept at their gates so they don't have to be de-iced on the runways. President Clinton says it's better to have no trade agreement with Japan than to have an empty agreement. The president made the comments this afternoon in a news conference with Japanese Prime Minister Morihiro Hosokawa. Mr. Clinton says Japan has been unwilling to open its markets to U.S. goods. Hosokawa confirmed that there was little progress in settling the trade dispute, but said that should not interfere with the strong relationship between Washington and Tokyo. The Space Shuttle Discovery has returned from an 8-day science mission. Despite weather concerns in Florida, the shuttle landed at the Kennedy Space Center. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Commander Charlie Bolden battled gusty winds and thick cloud cover to bring Discovery in for a landing. Dark, heavy clouds positioned themselves over the landing facility, a condition that is in violation of NASA's landing guidelines. But the shuttle must commit to a landing 1 hour before touchdown. At that time, officials predicted that the weather would improve. It did, slightly. Discovery's successful, albeit testy, landing brings to an end 8 days in space for the 6-member crew, which included the first Russian to fly aboard a U.S. space shuttle. Results of the mission's objectives were divided. Discovery's primary payload was never deployed. Technical problems kept the Wakefield Science Satellite connected to Discovery's mechanical arm. Other experiments inside the Spacehab Science Laboratory did proceed as planned. The crew also deployed a German research satellite. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
President Clinton has signed a federal government agency order to pursue a policy of environmental justice to protect inner cities and identify hazards that could be a health risk to America's poor. On Wall Street, stocks were mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials lost a half a point to close at 3894.78. This is NPR News. Illinois Congressman Dan Rostenkowski has repaid the U.S. Treasury more than $82,000 for purchases from a House Office Supply store. The purchases were originally billed to taxpayers. From Chicago, NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
Rostenkowski's finances have been under investigation by a federal grand jury for nearly 2 years. Federal records reveal that in January and February of this year, the powerful chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee repaid the government for items ranging from chairs with Rostenkowski's name engraved on them to crystal figurines, vases, and ashtrays that were handed out as gifts. Rostenkowski denied any wrongdoing, saying aides had made some of the purchases, and he said he repaid the government more than he may owe. In a statement, the congressman said, "I erred on the side of reimbursing the government for any item which even my fiercest political adversary could question." Rostenkowski is involved in a close Democratic primary race and is run for a 19th term as congressman. In Chicago, I'm Edward Lifson reporting.
A NATO source in Brussels says the organization needs final approval from UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali before airstrikes begin in Bosnia. The NATO allies have given Bosnian Serbs an ultimatum to withdraw heavy weapons from around Sarajevo by February 21st or face airstrikes. The source says Boutros-Ghali has to give his specific authority for the first airstrike. Ford Motor Company has recalled more than 31,000 Ranger trucks equipped with 2-liter engines for work on their emissions system. Ford and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency have determined the trucks emit nitrogen oxides at levels exceeding federal standards in the United States and Canada. Nearly 4,000 of the vehicles are in Canada. NASCAR driver Neil Bonnett has died in a crash at Daytona International Speedway. Bonnett was attempting to make a comeback after he suffered a series of head injuries in a crash in 1990. I'm Doreen McAllister, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring songwriters of rock and roll classics. We start with a 1986 interview with Ellie Greenwich. She co-wrote many of the girl group hits of the 1960s, including these. All the songs we've just heard were co-written by Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry, who were briefly married. With the exception of Chapel of Love, which Greenwich and Barry co-produced, all the records we heard were produced by Phil Spector, the first real genius of pop production. Ellie Greenwich also co-wrote Leader of the Pack, recorded by the Shangri-Las, I Want to Love Him So Bad by the Jelly Beans, River Deep Mountain High, recorded by Ike and Tina Turner, Maybe I Know, Leslie Gore, I Can Hear Music, The Beach Boys, and Doo Wah Diddy, recorded by Manfred Mann. I asked Ellie Greenwich about one of the first hits that she co-wrote and co-produced, Chapel of Love.
That song had originally been cut by the Ronettes. Phil Spector had cut it with the Ronettes, but never put it out. Why? Do not ask me. And we always believed in that song. We knew it had to be a spring release or a summer release because of the nature of, you know, Chapel getting married, June weddings, the whole thing. And what happened was when they did not put that, when Phil Spector didn't put that record out, Jeff and I said, we have to do something with it. And just at that time, a gentleman named Joe Jones came up from New Orleans with a whole slew of people. Amongst them was three girls, which we eventually named the Dixie Cups. And here were all these singers just hanging out at the office, you know, Lieber and Stoller's office. And we said, girls, come here a minute. And we went to the piano, and we played it for them, and they sang. So it's very, I mean, anybody could sing Chapel of Love, you know? And we said, we have to go in and make this record. And it's funny, in my whole career of being in the studio producing, there were only two songs that I literally walked out of a studio and said, either these records are going to be zippity-doo, nothing, go nowhere, or number one records. That was Chapel of Love and Leader of the Pack.
Did you have a special rapport with the singers and the girl groups, being a woman yourself?
I think initially, it's funny, back then, I was not just, well, here's my song, see ya. I got involved in everything. And it wasn't that accepted back then, a female being in that end of the business. A songwriter, a lyricist, automatic acceptance. A background singer, automatic acceptance. A writer, because Carole King and I were really the only female writers then that I know of that actually sat at the piano and sang the song and really got involved. And that wasn't... But what happened was eventually the girl said, gee, we have someone we can really relate to. Somebody we can talk to. We have headaches today. We want to tell somebody who's going to understand better than Ellie.
What were some of the problems that you had breaking in and getting accepted, being a woman? Because as you just pointed out, there really weren't many women songwriters in the early 60s.
Well, I think I was very fortunate in that most of the early things I got involved in became hits. So what choice did so many of these people have when I said, well, hey, you know, I have a little track record here. This was a hit, and this is doing well on the charts, and I'm doing, you know, and it was almost like, well... We don't love, you know, like the musicians would say, we don't love a woman telling us to go like this on your guitar. But I said, look at me as a thing. Forget, you know. And I think because of my success, it made it a little easier. Plus, I did a lot of co-producing with Jeff. So I had the little male protector on one side. They really didn't have much of a choice, did they?
You got married to each other, and, you know, after all, you'd written songs like Chapel of Love, you were writing all these, Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry, all these great love and wedding songs, Not Too Young to Get Married. Did you think that you were gonna have a marriage that was everything that the song said marriage was gonna be?
Well, I have to, like, flee in on something. I grew up in Levittown, Long Island, on the corner of Starlight and Springtime Lane. You tell me if I thought my marriage was... Yes, I did. I really believed in the little house with the white picket fence and together forevermore, and absolutely believed that I was really a dreamer. And I think that still can happen. Unfortunately, it didn't happen for us, and I think that was partly the business sport. But yes, I was very much a hopeful romantic.
My guest is Ellie Greenwich. How did you hook up with Phil Spector?
Oh, this is about a four-hour show. No. I had, at the time, I was writing with a guy named Tony Powers before I was writing with Jeff. And I was not yet signed to Lieber and Stoller, but I was on what they call a first refusal basis where I would go. I could use their offices as long as whatever I wrote, they heard first and had first choice whether they wanted it or not. They called me and told me that there was a guy coming up to the office who was cutting the Powers sisters. And did I have something for them? I said, sure. And I went to the office that day, and I'm there, and I'm nervous, and I'm playing my tune. I remember it was called It Was Me Yesterday. He never cut it. This person comes walking in with ruffles, and he's wandering around the room making noises, looking in the mirror. I mean, he was an eccentric human being. Very lovable once you got to know him and work with him, but initially it's sort of like, what is this? Rude to the point of, I kept stopping saying, do you want to hear my song or not? And by the fourth time of him wandering around and making noises and not listening, I got annoyed, and I slammed on the piano, and I said, forget it. I mean, forget it. And he's like, you don't tell Phil Spector, forget it. And he went storming out of the office. And Lieberman Stoller came running and like, what did you do? I said, who was that? I said, that was the most humiliating thing I've ever, I'm singing my heart out. I'm scared to death here. And this guy goes, like, he didn't even listen to me. That was the first meeting with Phil Spector. And then I played Lieberman Stoller shortly thereafter a song called Today I Met the Boy I'm Going to Marry, which they didn't like. And after three times of playing it, they said, nah, take it wherever you want. And I brought it to a publisher named Aaron Schroeder. Aaron says, I love it. I want it. I think I know someone perfect to cut this song. And 2 weeks later, he calls me. He goes, we have a meeting. I want you to go to 62nd Street and meet with Phil Spector. I said, does he know who's going to meet with him? And Phil had money, but he didn't connect it with being at Lieberman Stoller. We had a 2 o'clock appointment. I got there at 2 o'clock. He showed up at 6. And I waited the 4 hours, seething. He walked in, and he took one look at me, and I went, we have, we started off so wrong. And we had it out. I said, if I didn't want this record, I would never have sat here, but I want this record. I think this will be a great song. Blah, blah, blah. Went through it. I said, don't you ever be late again, and don't you make those noises. You listen to me. And he was so taken with the fact that I was like, I mean, I was doing this hysterically, though. I mean, like, I was so upset. But yet I sort of tongue-in-cheeked because I didn't want to get too serious. We hit it off so perfectly, and that was the beginning of our working relationship. We worked together all the time. And I then was married to Jeff Barry, so I figured, So I brought Jeff in, and then the three of us just really hit it off and just wrote a bunch of songs together.
You were talking about working with Phil Spector and how crazy he was. What's an example of Spector at his craziest?
And I say crazy with tenderness and with respect. I really must clarify that because people, oh, she called him crazy. He was just so eccentric. And I guess I was so conventional and, you know, from Levittown, Long Island, and, you know, everything was by the book that anything would have been like a little off. So he was really out there. I think the craziest thing Phil did that I was privy to was going to a recording session once where he had all his musicians wore short sleeve pink shirts with Phil Spector written on it, and stood up and saluted him when he walked in the room. And because most of the artists he cut were black artists, he had everybody stand before the session and sing We Shall Overcome before the date was started. I found that a little, you know, crazy and weird. Also, veering away from the actual studio experiences, we had spent like 3 or 4 days in California writing stuff together, and Phil was petrified of flying. And it was time to come back to New York, and Phil caused such a scene on the plane that people thought it was a bomb scare, and the plane had taken off, came back, and landed. We were searched. I figured my parents are going to see me in the paper in jail. They're not going to believe this. But Phil purported to have a heart attack and carried on so crazily, but they said, we got to turn this plane back. And they said, there's this maniac on the plane who's carrying on. So Phil would do things that were just not, you know, overly accepted, especially back then. He was filled with antics. Phil was filled with antics.
One of the big hit songs that you wrote was Leader of the Pack, which you co-wrote. And it was performed by the Shangri-Las, who I always think of as being the tramps of the girl groups because they had such a tough
You think
image.
They were trampier than the Ronettes? I mean, Terry, please.
Oh. How did you get to work with those Shangri-Las?
Well, there was a guy that I knew named George Morton, because he was also one that was a little eccentric and like would never show up on time, so we ended up calling him Shatter Morton. So George calls me. He has this tape and a bunch of girls he wants me to hear. Brought the tape to the office, and this thing went on. He did this male narration. It was 7 minutes long. I said, no, we can't do that. But there was something very interesting in this song. Different. I said, who is this singing? This same black thing? You know, I said, wow, it's a very different sound. Saw a picture of them and said, see, that there's where, what an added thing, what an interesting looking little group here. And met with them, and the record came out. Big hit. It's now time for a follow-up. So Shadow said, we got to write something together. And at that time, when you made money, you bought yourself boots or motorcycles. I mean, that was really what it was all about. So everybody, every male, Jeff, Shadow, the engineer, the arranger, they all had motorcycles, and they were always riding motorcycles. I said, why don't we do something with motorcycles? okay, we can call it. There's always a leader. So the head of the group. I said, no, it doesn't sound good. And we just threw titles around. Leader of the Pack sounded important. And Shadow Morton also had a habit of writing little soap operas. His songs all became these little mini soap operas, right? So with his influence, we were, you know, we melodically did certain things, whatever. And he had to have this, had to be a sick song. Let's get, and Jeff had written Tell Laura I Love Her. So he was used to being about with the sick element. This was new for me. I said, hey, as long as it's not too disgusting and I can deal with it. So I think we had everything from the sound effects to motorcycles to boy loving, you know, the girl loving the boy that's forbidden. I mean, all these, death, my God. I mean, it was like everything was in there. And once again, I like I said, and there's the way Mary sounded, the way the whole group looked. I thought the picture was a perfect picture and the record was just the perfect kind of a thing to be a top record.
Why don't we hear it? Okay.
Okay.
This is Leader of the Pack, co-written by my guest Ellie Greenwich and performed by the Shangri-Las.
Is she really going out with him?
Well, there she is. Let's ask her.
Betty, is that Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, it must be great riding with him. Is he picking you up after school today?
Mm-mm.
By the way, where'd you meet him?
That's when I fell for the leader of the pack. My folks were always putting him down.
Down, down.
They said he came from the wrong side of town.
What do you mean when you say that he came from the wrong side of town?
They told me he was bad.
Small, he kissed me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. Whether he heard, I'll never know.
I felt so helpless, what could I do?
Our interview with Ellie Greenwich was recorded in 1986. Carole King got her start writing hits for other singers. Like Ellie Greenwich, she worked out of the Brill Building, which was headquarters to a lot of top 40 writers. Carole King will tell us about those days in an interview recorded in 1989. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. Before Carole King had hit records of her own, she wrote songs that became hits for other singers.
Sweet. On the roof.
You make me feel. You make me
Carole King and her first husband, lyricist Jerry Goffin, were one of the most successful songwriting teams of the 60s. Their other hits included Some Kind of Wonderful, Every Breath I Take, Take Good Care of My Baby, The Locomotion, Chains, Don't Say Nothing Bad, and I'm Into Something Good. In the late 60s, King stepped out from behind the scenes and started writing music and lyrics to perform herself.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door. Doesn't help to know you're just time away.
That's from King's 1971 album, Tapestry, which remained on the charts for 6 years and broke the record for best-selling album of all time. When Carole King first started writing professionally, she worked with Jerry Goffin at a New York publishing company owned by Don Kirshner. Kirshner is the rock producer who hosted late-night rock concerts on TV and produced The Monkees. I wondered if it was strange to be turning out songs in a cubicle in a Manhattan office building.
Didn't matter where we did it. It was just as easy to do it there as at home, sometimes easier because, we had the kids at home. But also, in the office building, just as often, we'd have one of the kids in the room. One of said kids being, of course, Louise Goffin, who has had 3 albums out on her own.
Mm-hmm.
So she got her training really early and on the spot.
So were there like a whole corridor of offices with pianos in them and songwriters
banging
out new tunes?
It's by now, it's probably fairly well known, the cubicle situation where we would be in one cubicle and say Man and Wild would be in another cubicle and some other team would be in the third cubicle and we'd hear each other trying to write the same song.
Were you given assignments? You
know, always.
Like, what would an assignment be like?
The Drifters are just coming off a top 10 hit and we want to get the next one. Donnie Kirshner was really motivated and motivating. You know, he was kind of a daddy figure, I guess, and we really wanted to do it for Donnie. He just kept us motivated and playing off against each other, and it was really fun. It was very competitive, but it was also fun, and the challenge of writing for new people all the time really honed our skills at writing on assignment, doing demos quickly, professionally, and cheaply. Oh, God, cheaply.
Well, the demos are the records that you'd cut for a group who was going to be recording one of your songs, and the demo would show how it's supposed to sound, you know, the melody, the
right.
lyrics, and everything. What makes a good demo?
I don't know. It just has an energy. In many cases, the sounds were really primitive. The performances were flawed. There were scratchy notes on the vocal and wrong notes on the guitar and all that stuff. And tape hiss, because we kept bouncing. At that time, the demos were monaural, one track. That's all we had. And so we just bounced back and forth. So now some of the demos eventually became records because people were telling Kirshner that the demos were so good that he said, more money to be made. Why don't I put them out? So my demo for Bobby V of It Might As Well Rain Until September became my first solo record in that decade anyway. The others before that were not worth mentioning. And Locomotion by Little Eva was in fact a demo for Dee Dee Sharp. And it's funny, you hear it and you hear the drum thing in the beginning, you know, the roll, and before it you hear this enormous amount of tape hiss from the bouncing back and forth from monaural to monaural. But you know, I always liked the fact that they were raw and real, and if there were mistakes and tape hiss, it didn't matter because it was happening.
Carole King, recorded in 1989. Carole King has a new live album called In Concert, and she has a PBS special coming up in March. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Oh, baby, what you've done to me.
What you've done to me.
You make me feel so good inside.
Good inside.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the rock and roll songwriting and production team of Lieber and Stoller. They wrote for the Drifters, the Coasters, and Elvis. We opened this archive edition with a song co-written by Ellie Greenwich, Be My Baby. We'll close the show with the singer who made that song a hit, Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes. That's all coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Residents from the Gulf Coast to New England are dealing with freezing rain, wind-whipped snow, and numbing cold. Hundreds of thousands of people have had their power knocked out, and schools and businesses have closed. In Washington, the federal government was closed, with only essential personnel told to report. Today's snow and freezing rain is the latest in a series of storms that have wreaked havoc on the eastern half of the nation this winter. The UN Security Council has postponed its debate on the crisis in Bosnia until Monday because of the bad weather in New York. Today's session was supposed to allow the countries to clarify their positions on the Bosnian conflict. The meeting is not intended to have any effect on UN Security General Boutros Boutros-Ghali's call for NATO airstrikes against Bosnian Serb forces if they refuse to pull their heavy weaponry from around Sarajevo. Meanwhile, Boutros-Ghali has decided that NATO warplanes can be called in to protect UN troops throughout Bosnia. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Until now, close air support could only be used to protect UN troops in two separate areas, the besieged town of Srebrenica and the airport at Tuzla. But now, Boutros-Ghali has decided to use close air support to protect UN troops throughout Bosnia. At the same time, the Secretary General has decided to delegate the authority to initiate the first airstrikes against gun positions in Sarajevo to Yasushi Akashi, his special representative for Yugoslavia. However, before any airstrikes can be carried out against gun positions, the UN must first finalize procedures. A UN spokesman said he did not know how long this would take. At the same time, in a move that suggests airstrikes won't be launched automatically, the Secretary General says Akashi must take into account the security of UN military and civilian personnel, as well as the ongoing humanitarian relief operations in Bosnia. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison has been cleared of charges that she violated ethics laws when she was Texas state treasurer. A state judge ordered the jury to acquit Hutchison after the prosecutor refused to proceed in a dispute over evidence. The Labor Department reports that producer price index rose 0.2% last month. It's a relatively small increase, but still the largest in 4 months. The government says a drop in food costs offset the biggest increase in gasoline prices in more than 3 years. The Commerce Department reported this morning that retail sales fell 0.5% last month. It was the first decline in 10 months. Analysts blame the drop on the severe winter weather that gripped many parts of the country, as well as the California earthquake. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 0.5 point to close at 3894.78. Declines led advances by a margin of 4-3 in heavy trading. This is National Public Radio News. The Israeli police minister has threatened to seal off the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip to keep Palestinians from entering Israel. The threat comes after two Israelis were murdered this week. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Police Minister Moshe Shakal says he won't hesitate to ask for a complete closure of the occupied territories if there's more violence against Israelis. He was reacting to the murders inside Israel of a cab driver and a farmer. The extremist group Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility for the cab driver's murder. The farmer was killed by an Arab employee. Shakal says he expects more violence during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which began today. Islamic Jihad and Hamas have promised to increase attacks against Israelis during Ramadan. Israel has put more troops in the territories and in East Jerusalem. Closing the territories would prevent Palestinians from traveling into Israel to work, and presumably would make it harder for the extremist groups to carry out their threats. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
President Clinton has ordered federal government agencies to pursue a policy of environmental justice to protect inner cities and identify hazards that could be a health risk to the poor in America. The executive order would affect lead paint removal in public housing and water pollution cleanup in urban rivers, where poor residents often fish. In a statement, the president said all Americans have a right to be protected from pollution, not just those who can afford to live in the cleanest, safest communities. House and Senate negotiators have reached an agreement on a compromise aid package for victims of the Los Angeles earthquake. The package totals $8.6 billion. The woman who blew the whistle on the Tailhook sex scandal is resigning from the Navy. NBC News reports Lieutenant Paula Coughlin says her Tailhook assault and the attacks on her afterwards are the reason why she's resigning. I'm Doreen McAllister, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come.
About 100 different singers recorded that song, from Wilbert Harrison, who had the original hit, to the Beatles and Sammy Davis Jr. My guests are the two guys collecting the songwriting royalties, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. This team has written many rock and roll classics for Elvis Presley, the Clovers, the Coasters, the Drifters, and Benny King. Their songs include Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy, Searchin', and Stand By Me. They not only wrote the songs, they often produced the records. In fact, Lieber and Stoller were the first rock and roll producers to actually get credit on the record for their work. Rock and roll's greatest producer, Phil Spector, got his start as Lieber and Stoller's assistant. We're going to hear a 1991 interview with Lieber and Stoller. That year, Rhino Records released a CD of their classic songs. It opens with the original 1953 recording of Hound Dog, sung by Big Mama Thornton. This was the first session Lieber and Stoller produced themselves.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Well, Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The record we've been listening to, Big Mama Thornton's recording of Hound Dog, was your first major hit as songwriters and producers. You wrote the song for her. What was it about her that led to this song?
Well, Mike and I were invited to Johnny Otis's rehearsal studio to listen to and look at some of his artists. Big Mama was one of them, and she was really formidable. She was scary looking. She was big, and she must have weighed about anywhere from 275 to 350, and she had this really gutty, guttural, growling sound in her voice. And the both of us fell in love with her, and we just loved what she looked like, and we loved what she sounded like. She sang Ball and Chain, and we decided to take off that minute and go to Mike's house and try to write something for her.
Well, how did you come up with this song, though?
Well, Mike was driving, and I was banging on the roof of the car, and I was trying to come up with something nasty that would be, at the same time, playable, that wouldn't be censored, you know? And the closest I could get to what I was thinking was, you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
So you were thinking four-letter word, epithet, and we came up with Hound Dog.
Right, which sort of, you know, made it, it felt right, and it seemed like it would be passable.
Mike, let me ask you how you think Elvis handled the song differently from Big Mama Thornton.
How he handled it differently? Yeah. Well, he handled it very differently. He didn't sing it in the same tradition. of blues intonation that Big Mama used. And also, the lyrics were considerably different because Big Mama's, the way the song was written for Big Mama is really about a gigolo. It's a woman complaining about a gigolo. And Elvis couldn't sing that song. So he sang a version of it, which I think, as I'm told, he heard from a lounge act in Las Vegas, that he heard singing the song in Vegas.
Now, you wrote several songs for Elvis, including Jailhouse Rock. Why don't we play a little bit of that? Jailhouse Rock, written by my guests Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Now, you wrote a lot of songs for Elvis's movies. This was really one of the best songs. Some of the movies had really awful songs in them. Did you have to write some of those awful songs?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Oh, we loved writing the awful songs because they were more fun. Things like Steadfast, Loyal and True, you know, songs where he was supposedly graduating high school. I don't think Elvis graduated high school, but maybe he did. But we had to write these terrible songs.
How'd you feel about having to write terrible songs? Why did you enjoy it?
Because it was funny.
Uh-huh.
It was amusing.
Yeah, it was kind of like anti-rock and roll.
Well, the thing was that the problem was this. You got a script, and there would be a moment in a scene where they would want a song. Now, we would tell the director, we would tell Hal Wallace, the producer, we'd say, look, you know, we're not trying to get out of writing a song, but this is really a dumb place for a song, you know? I mean, the guy's about to go into the boys' room and comb his hair, and I don't know why he has to sing, I'm going into the boys' room to comb my hair. And they'd say, we want the song. So we'd write it. So a lot of those songs that shouldn't have been written were written and recorded, and they're there for posterity.
A lot of the songs that you wrote over the years were novelty songs, songs like Charlie Brown, Love Potion Number 9, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy. I think I just named all Coaster's songs here. But how did you get so involved with novelty songs?
We didn't think of them as novelties.
We thought of them dark as dramas. We were both trying to imitate Tolstoy and Dickens, and I guess we just fell short of the mark. We wrote novelty songs because we're both essentially gag writers, and we like to tell funny stories and anecdotes. And this is just a way of telling funny stories set to music.
Well, let me play one of your novelty songs that's on the Rhino Records anthology that's just been released of some of your songs. And this is Charlie Brown.
V-V-5-5-4-4-4. I smell smoke in the auditorium.
Everybody always picking on me.
That's him on his knees.
I was wondering if one of the reasons why you wrote so many novelty songs is had to do with that you were two white Jews writing for a lot of R&B groups who were black. I don't know how self-conscious you were about that, but I was thinking, well, maybe it was easier in a way to write songs that were funny as opposed to maybe the presumptuousness of writing something that was really heartfelt when you were writing for other people. Though you wrote a lot of those songs, too.
Well, to begin with, these two white Jews really experienced themselves as black. I was brought up in an essentially predominantly black neighborhood in South Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And Stoller can speak for himself, but he went to interracial camps when he was a kid. No, it's not that. We really felt that we were very black, and we acted black, and we spoke black, And it wasn't really till later on, when you hear these later songs, like 1959 and 60, the late Coasters things, mm-hmm. that are really kind of generalized rock and roll for mass market. But the early stuff that we wrote things like, our early songs were not really novelty. They were blues. Hound Dog is a buck dance blues for Big Mama. And Kansas City is a 12-bar blues, certainly not a novelty song. All the early stuff, with Jimmy Witherspoon.
And Hard Times that we wrote for Charles Brown.
These are all blues. And we wrote wrote exclusively for black artists because that's how we felt. And it wasn't until later on that we started to stretch a little bit and when we moved actually from L.A. to New York, started to write for a broader market.
We'll be back with Lieber and Stoller after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller are my guests. Now, after you were writing songs for a while, you started producing the records of the people who were doing your songs. This was in the days before record producers were considered to be the auteurs of, you know, of the music industry. Why did you get into the production? Why did you want that control?
Well, self-defense, really.
We needed to protect the intention of our work because we had had a few experiences early on where we would deliver a song on a piece of paper, and it didn't come out the way we had intended it at all. It was another aesthetic entirely.
Give me an example.
And in order to make it sound the way we planned to make it, we had to do it ourselves.
For instance, we'd come in with what we thought was like a sort of a Texas shuffle, you know, a blues.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be on paper, and we didn't have a demo, and they would turn it over. Because we were somewhat hot, they'd take it that way, and they would turn it over to an A&R man, say at Capitol or at CBS, whatever. And these were good producers, but they had their own sense of what was correct and what was happening, and they weren't down into rhythm and blues. They were still rooted in swing and jazz at that time. And they would, you know, we would have something that should sound like either a Texas pickup band or Memphis Slim, and they would make a record that would sound like Tommy Dorsey or Benny Goodman's swing band, and it would just be wrong. And so after a couple of these disappointments, we decided to, in self-defense, to learn how to produce records ourselves so we could make our songs come off the way they were intended.
One of the things that you are famous for having pioneered was bringing a string section to rock and roll or to rhythm and
blues. That was Mike's fault.
Yeah, let me ask you, you know, on the Drifters recording of There Goes My Baby, that's the classic example of you bringing strings on. What went through your mind to do it?
I can tell you exactly what was on my mind. Just the line, the melodic line. And I was playing it. I used to joke about this one because it sounded like Borodin and I sounded like one of the Caucasian melodies. And
I don't know if you get the pun, but he's been saying this for many years, and I always thought it was funny.
Right.
The fact that he would use a Caucasian melody on this.
But it was, Jerry heard it, and he said, that sounds like strings. And I said, why not? And so why not? We had five violins and one cello, and they were all basically playing in unison.
Because Jerry Wexler wouldn't spring for six violins and two celli.
Was it hard to find string players who could play with the right spirit on a session with the Drifters?
No, they didn't have to play with the right spirit. They just had to play a Caucasian melody. And so we hired a lot of Caucasian string players.
Now, another thing that happened on this record was you introduced a Latin rhythm that you used.
The Bayon rhythm was one that both Jerry and I adored. It was I first heard it in the film Anna with Silvana Mangano, and they had a Brazilian group And the record, Anna, became a fairly big hit, and it was a popular melody. And I just loved the rhythm on it, and we had always looked for a place to use it. We'd used it maybe once before on a early record that was not particularly successful. And we had the opportunity to use it on this record date, and there happened to be a timpani left over from another recording session in the studio. And we used it. Now, the drummer was not a percussionist. He was just a trap drummer, and he didn't know how to use the tuning pedal on the timp. So he played one note throughout the entire thing, which gave it a rather bizarre, muddy bottom with all kinds of weird overtones. It was kind of fascinating, though. And that's where we first had a successful use of that Bayonne rhythm. Which, in case anybody's wondering, is boom, 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 boom.
Which finally was used, I think, and is responsible for maybe over 1,000 hits, because this Brazilian rhythm supports a slow ballad without the ballad seeming to be slow or sluggish. It keeps it moving, and everyone from Burt Bacharach to Phil Spector to you name it, have leaned heavily on the support of this rhythm pattern.
Our interview with Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller was recorded in 1991. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, listen, I'm thinking of organizing a demonstration of people from the Northeast who want to bring back the greenhouse effect. What do you think?
You know, I hadn't thought about that. It would make sense. It's been a real tough winter so far, a long winter already. And we have some weather news tonight on our program. I'll talk with a county official in Philippi, West Virginia. The Tigert River there has been over the banks, lots of ice and snow and rain. I'll speak with a woman in Oxford, Mississippi. Ice is the problem there as well. No electricity, no water, no food. Other news, Mara Liasson reports on the tough trade talks with Japan. As the Japanese prime minister comes to visit, there's going to be no trade deal. And Bob Mondello on Box Office Draws.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This archive edition of Fresh Air has featured interviews with some of the great early rock and roll songwriters. We open the show with a recording of Be My Baby, which was co-written by today's first guest, Ellie Greenwich. We're closing the show with the singer who made that song a hit, Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes. Our interview was recorded in 1987. Remember the Bayonne rhythm that Lieber and Stoller talked about popularizing? Here it is again. Hear the song. Did the songwriter sing it for you before you performed it the first time?
Well, the first time I heard it, you know, Phil and those were and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry. We met in a little studio, and they started writing around me. And I guess I was 16 years old, and very shy, and I liked Phil at the time, and he liked me. I think they wrote it all around that. You know, our little love affair at the beginning. I think it was all a part of that.
Do you remember the recording session?
Like it was yesterday.
What was it like?
It was incredible because there I was in California recording, and I'd never left New York. I'd never been out of New York in my whole life, and there I am on a plane going to California by myself without the other two Ronettes just to do the lead part. And I loved it. I love it till today. I still love it. I mean, it's just a record that I remember that day being in the studio. I remember what color dress I was wearing. I remember everything.
One of the things you do on this record is your famous, I can't even imitate this, but your famous "Whoa-oh."
Yes.
How did you come up with that? Was that something you just started singing?
No, it was like Frankie Lyman used to sing, "Why do birds sing so gay? And love is away with break of day. Why do they fall in love?" And so I sort of got it from him, and it was like my own little "Oh-ohs" came out. And I think it's just something that I started and it stuck.
You formed the Ronettes with two of your cousins when you were all teenagers.
No, a sister and a cousin.
A sister and a cousin, okay. And how did you learn to sing harmonies?
Actually, it was like a bunch of cousins. I had so many first cousins. It was like three other girls besides the two Ronettes, and it was a boy cousin singing lead, and it just sort of narrowed down to one. And I remember the three of us being on the rooftop, like learning routines, because we never had a choreographer or anything. We sort of did what the street dances and stuff, and we just made it three. It was a family, and we had a sort of strict upbringing. So we couldn't go out, and we could look out in the street and watch other girls walk and everything, but we couldn't go out. So we stayed in the house, and that's how we all just started singing.
You broke into the music business by being a dancer at the Peppermint Lounge, being a dancer on the Murray the K Show,
right,
singing backup vocals. Did you do things in those early days to help get yourself noticed? Did you either like dress in such a way as to call attention to yourself? Okay, what'd you do?
First of all, we tried to. You have to have a gimmick in this business, we figured. And so we wore our hair extra high, you know, the beehives in the 60s. And we wore eyeliner, you know, like Chinese eyes almost. And we wore slits up the side of our dresses because we sang and danced. We had a lot of aunts. My mother has like six sisters. And so that's seven of them dressing us. And they told us to put a cigarette in our mouth. And we stood outside the Peppermint Lounge, dressed just alike. And I was so glad because at 14 I was smoking. They just didn't know it. And it was great because we stood online and we had to look older. So we had to exaggerate everything because all of us were underage.
Now, you know, it always made me think that you were really tough, really streetwise.
No.
Were you? No.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, when we heard about people being junkies or dope addicts, I would ask my mother, "Well, let me see one," because the way my family would talk about them, it was like it was a disease, because I was very young and I didn't know. So I wasn't a tough streetwise kid at all, but we just did all the dances, and I loved it. From the time I was 3 years old, when my whole family applauded me, I remember the song was "Jambalina Covey, Spine of Philly Gumbo. 'Cause tonight I'm gonna meet Mom Shadow Mio. Pick a spot filled with Guy Handy Gale. Son of a gun, we're having fun on the bayou." And I think that's when I got my ho 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 ho. And then my family just started applauding me, and I was like 3 years old. And I said, "That's what I wanna be the rest of my life. I wanna perform."
Ronnie Spector, recorded in 1987. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive show was produced with assistance from Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, tight pants, tight sweaters, and high-heeled shoes. We talk with Anne Margaret, a sex symbol in the 60s. She's now starring opposite two grumpy old men. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.